Hello, I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the perfect gift this Valentine's Day is the gift of heart health. Along with Valentine's Day, February marks American Heart Month, a great time to commit to a healthy lifestyle and make small changes that can lead to a lifetime of heart health. So tonight on Health Matters, we are going to discuss heart health. And please remember, as you know, Health Matters is a live weekly show here on Red River Radio where we discuss topics that are important for public health. And we invite you, our listeners, to join in this discussion. And you can call and ask a question or offer a comment to 1-800-552-8502. Or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Let's go ahead and meet a couple of the guests that we have with us here tonight.
Hello, I'm Jared Mitchell. I'm the Outpatient Cardiac Rehab Coordinator at Willis Knighton Health System.
Welcome back to Health Matters, Jared.
Thank you very much.
Hi, and I'm Julie Hartley. I'm registered dietitian at Willis Knighton and also exercise instructor there, and also work with Jared in the cardiac rehab department.
Welcome, Julie. We do have a cardiologist on call, so let's see. Let's see if we can get the physician here, and we'll go ahead and open the phone lines for your calls or questions about heart health. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Jared, you've been here before on Health Matters, and you know it seems like. Doesn't matter what topic that we talk about when it comes to heart disease or diabetes or obesity. We recently did a show. We were talking about New Year's resolutions, you know, things to sort of kickstart a healthy new year. From your perspective, even with someone who doesn't have heart disease, how would you counsel them in terms of beginning to think about how to take good care of their heart? Maybe somebody starting to, you know, inch towards middle age. What are some of the things that you think about in terms of having a healthy heart?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed that at our discussion on the New Year's resolutions. One of the things that I wish I would have mentioned is kind of, you know, hey, what is your foundation? Who are you? You know, some businesses have mission statements, and I think it's important for us to have kind of like a mission statement in of ourselves. So the first thing I think what's important in regards to New Year's resolutions or heart health is to say, hey, is this who I am? Is this what I want to be? Is this one of my goals to be heart healthy? And it's not always all just about heart health. Tons of things that are beneficial for heart health. The same goes for boosting your immunity, such as, again, exercise, eating right, stress management, good emotions. All those have been proven to, you know, we're talking about, you know, a lot of people sick or flu season this time of year. Exercise is great on boosting immunity. Definitely a great thing for heart health. I just think overall comprehensive healthiness should be a goal for everyone. Very important.
So you mentioned the business model of having a mission statement. Would you recommend that, you know, individuals maybe actually write something out in terms of this is my health mission statement, maybe something to put on the, you know, the kitchen counter or on the refrigerator or somewhere where they can sort of be reminded regularly about what is their mission for their health?
Exactly. I mean, that's where it all starts. Whatever that you say, hey, this is what I want to be. If it's a certain weight goal, if it's a certain thing, well, hey, I want to run a 5K. All right. Then all your decisions branch off from that. If you say, hey, I want to eat heart healthy. I want to get my cholesterol down to a certain way. Hey, then all your decisions branch off from there. And then that helps you make a wise choice when those decisions come about, when you're at a restaurant or when you're at the grocery store. If your mission is to get to a certain point, maybe you'll make a wiser decision when it comes to that time.
This is Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host tonight for Health Matters, and our topic is heart health. It's February, and Valentine's Day is just around the corner. You can call us and ask us a question about heart health at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Cardiac rehabilitation expert Jared Mitchell is here with us, as well as Julie Hartley, a dietitian as well as fitness specialist with the Willis-Knighton Health System as well. Again, the number for your questions or comments here on Red River Radio's Health Matters show tonight, it's 1-800-552-8502. Julie, when you think about a mission statement and heart health, what comes to mind?
Yeah, I loved everything Jared said. We're all about goals, and prevention is just really the name of the game. You had mentioned, you know, should somebody be thinking about that as they inch towards middle age? And now our children are just as unhealthy. If, you know, this will be the first generation that does not live as long as their parents. And so it's just really never too early to start with that. So we really want to drive home goals, you know, just like Jared was saying. I love the idea of mission statement, and also just making very specific goals. What I find is that people don't know how to do that very well. They'll say in January, y'all probably talked about this, weight loss is just a goal. Or they'll say, I just need to lose weight. And it's not very specific enough, and it's not very measurable. So we really try to set goals that are going to get them to, you know, what they want, but kind of break them down into really small incremental steps. So if somebody said, I wanted to lose weight, well, let's see what two habits, you know, I don't want to, there might be 10 habits they need to work on, but maybe we break it down and say, you know, what are the two top things you think are impeding your health right now? Are you drinking too many sodas? Are you not exercising? Or, you know, you're smoking, whatever it is. And then we really break it down. You're not eating enough vegetables. Well, you know, let's say 5 days a week, you know, let's make a salad your lunch, you know, so really very specific goals. That way we can start to make lifestyle changes.
And when we talk about things like exercise, weight loss, goals around eating and things along those lines, it's probably important to remind people what the risk factors for heart disease are, and what we categorize as modifiable risk factors, things that we can change, things that we can do differently, mm-hmm. and things that are not modifiable in terms of risk factors. Jared, what are some of the risk factors that we are sort of born with that we can't really change?
Well, our age is the first one there. As we age, that is a factor. At a certain point, you know, males are more prone to it. But at a certain point, you know, I hesitate really saying that because, you know, heart disease is one of the main things for women as well, as far as affecting them. So you got those things, and family history is one of them. And, you know, I tell you, some people I will, you know, visit with them or counsel them, and they're going to say, hey, I got family history of heart disease, ain't nothing I can do about that. And they think it's a green light to go ahead and do whatever. And that can be so farther from the truth. I love Joe Piscatella. He's one of the guys I kind of look up to. He had bypass at age 32. And the doctor told him, you might as well forget those goals of seeing your grandchildren. Because he was, you know, at 32, big family history. The doctor gave him really no hope for a longevity. Well, he's going real strong right now. He's in his 60s now. So if anyone, I would encourage people to look up that name or read some of his books. But he now sends like a letter to that doctor every year on his birthday, and does that. And so lifestyle changes really matter. Don't let that family history thing be something that's, you know, if you don't let that be a cop out, because great things can happen from doing things that you can control.
Yeah, that reminds me of a quip that one of the very charismatic professors that taught me in medical school had about telling patients about how their future may be bleak. And what they would then do on your grave, you know, when they outlived you. So doctors are notorious in terms of, you know, being overconfident in their ability to predict the future at times. And so I think a little bit of humility goes a long ways when it comes to, you know, really understanding where patients are. So in terms of family history, let's say, Jared, you're working with somebody, maybe they've had their first heart attack and they're in their 40s and they're entering cardiac rehab. What do you counsel them any differently than you would, say, someone who's in their 70s or 60s who's undergoing the same process? Should we take a more aggressive approach in the younger, in, you know, younger generations that may have a stronger family history?
I think the approach may be slightly different, but really, I mean, whatever their needs are, that's what we're going to focus on no matter what age. For that age group, they may feel have a more bleak outlook since they're so young and versus, you know, the normal age. So our goal is to make sure emotionally and their outlook is better, because having a more positive outlook is very good for overall health as well. And so, you know, I think our strategy is pretty much the same no matter which age, but we're just going to really focus on things that they need to improve and make sure that they, again, have that foundation, have that desire, have that motivation to go in there and improve those type needs.
And one of the things that cardiologists do talk about is that that risk factor of having a first degree relative who had a myocardial infarction under the age of 50 is a significant risk factor. And, you know, taking extra steps to make sure that, you know, smoking, control of blood pressure, control of lipid levels, all of those issues that relate to secondary risk factors, I think someone who has that first degree family history, really it would behoove them to double down on that risk factor modifications in terms of the other things that they can do. A prophylactic aspirin, you know, maybe even a statin if their cholesterol is even a little bit elevated, because we do know in certain individuals, coronary artery disease happens more aggressively. It happens earlier in life. Their infarctions or their heart attacks are bigger. It happens in the bigger arteries, which means a bigger heart attack, more likely to be a more fatal heart attack. And so, you know, that's one of the things that really breaks my heart when I hear about, you know, it's typically a male in his 40s, has young children, has a young family, and never really has a history of heart disease, but he has risk factors, and that being one of them, the family history. Mm-hmm. And has that first cardiac event as a fatal MI or a near fatal MI. And so, you know, those are things that we need to emphasize to the public, is that if you know someone who has a strong family history and they're coasting along, taking it for granted that it hasn't happened yet, is to go to the doctor and get checked out and go ahead and look at those risk factors that can be modified. Mm-hmm. Julie, from your standpoint, let's talk a little bit about heart disease in women. Mm-hmm. Heart attacks can present a little bit differently in women, from what I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. But just like Jared said, you know, many women don't think about heart disease as the number one killer for women. They think it might be breast cancer because it gets more attention. And so sometimes the symptoms that they're having just go unnoticed because it's not something that they are, you know, expecting. So we really want to get the word out about women. It is still the number one killer in heart, you know, is heart disease for them as well.
So, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, premenopausal versus postmenopausal states, is it recommended that women take, you know, take a really strong look at their risk factor profile when they're making that decision in terms of, you know, whether or not to treat menopausal symptoms?
Well, sure. And, you know, just like you said, there are so many different risk factors. They also need to look at genetics as well, too. We think about it as, again, just the men. But I'm encouraged so much with lifestyle medicine. We really have no drugs like the, you know, what lifestyle medicine can do. And, you know, we have a saying, too. We say that lifestyle, genetics loads the gun, but lifestyle pulls the trigger. And so there really is research to back that up, to say that, you know, if you are predisposed to, you know, heart disease, you have that risk factor, you do have to take all those precautions, you know, whether it is, you know, treating it hormonally or looking at how you treat hormonally before and after menopause. All those kinds of things will be significant to look at, too. But just to know that that research does show, just because you're predisposed, your lifestyle can cut the risk in half. And that's significant numbers. But that same research research also showed that even if you had really good genes and you had a terrible lifestyle, it also increased your risk, you know, more than half too. So the lifestyle medicine is really such an important thing to do, you know, so early on, way before we ever get to menopause.
And it's something that, you know, providers are not necessarily trained, you know, to emphasize that so much because we have procedures to schedule. We have medications to prescribe.
Sure.
We have lots of, you know, other, you know, medical advances to consider when a patient presents with a disease, as opposed to thinking about the person that they could be without, you know, this disease burdening them in terms of having to take medications and come to the doctor so often and go through so many diagnostic tests yearly. So those are really excellent points. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio, and we are discussing heart health here the first day of February in 2018. And you can call and ask us questions about heart health at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Our guests tonight include Mr. Jared Mitchell with the Willis-Knighton Cardiac Rehabilitation Program, as well as Ms. Julie Hartley. She's a dietitian with the Willis-Knighton Health System, as well as a personal fitness expert. Jared, when you talk about rehabilitation to a heart patient, let's just sort of go through what you would guide them through in terms of getting back to an exercise regime. What goal setting parameters do you discuss with them during that initial encounter?
Well, when I'm visit patients in the hospital, I definitely want to, you know, inform them of what cardiac rehab's all about. And it's not just an exercise program. We focus on all the risk factors and heart health needs. It's a total heart health program. One of the things I do tell them is say, hey, you know, we want to get you back doing the thing that you normally do. That's kind of a concern for heart patients. They feel like, well, things may not be the same, and it will be a new normal, but we want to, you know, give them some comfort knowing, hey, we want you back doing your normal stuff, because that's very important physically, very important emotionally. So that's our point that we want to get across. And early on in the program, they may have some limitations on what they can do. If a patient had a bypass, they're going to be limited on the upper body. And then also, it's just customary with any type of exercise program, you start at a little baseline. You don't max out initially, and so we definitely exercise them at a lower level initially, make sure their heart rate and rhythm's looking well, their blood pressure, their oxygen is all looking very good, and then we just gradually increase them up from there. And again, going back to bypass patients, then we, at the appropriate time, you know, around 6 to 7 weeks post-op, and then we can incorporate some upper body exercises and just a great overall comprehensive program to complete their recovery, you know, and their heart issue.
In patients who have had a bypass, do you find that more often than not, their exercise tolerance goes up fairly quickly following the restoration of good coronary blood flow compared to, you know, the state that they may have been in preoperatively, even though they have this, you know, massive, you know, chest incision that's healing?
Right. There's going to be some obvious, you know, discomfort there and limitations there. But you are perfectly right, because one of those symptoms that sometimes goes unnoticed is just a lack of energy or maybe shortness of breath, and that goes on sometimes for, it could be for some patients a couple of years. I've had some tell me that, just the past year I've kind of just been down on energy. I just thought I was just getting older. Well, that was a lack of blood flow, and so now they've got better blood flow. Boy, they've got another pep in their step. And so, yeah, they feel more energized. They feel like they're able to do more stuff. And an interesting statistic that I share with people a lot is that after being diagnosed with heart disease, They did a study. About two-thirds of people are saying, hey, my life is better after being diagnosed with heart disease. And that's kind of odd, and I get some wide eyes when I tell people that. But one of the factors that lead to that statistic is, hey, I got better blood flow. The cardiologist and the surgeons did a fantastic job at restoring some better blood flow, and now they feel better because of that better blood flow.
Let's go ahead and take our first caller of the evening. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. This is Randall Kuhn, and I'm glad Dr. Brewer is there tonight, as well as the rest of you. He's my pain doctor, and I have had quite a bit of endocrinology problems, adrenal fatigue and Addisonian crisis, which keeps, you were talking about extreme fatigue, that a couple of weeks ago, I couldn't get out of bed. It was just, I had to cancel Dr. Brewer's appointment, which I never do. And but Tommy Brown was my cardiologist and my fraternity brother, and miss him, and I've got to figure out who to replace with that. But I guess my question is, my wife had her first bypass, terrible heart attack at 37, and then died at 50. And I've got a son that's got her genetics, but he's taking care of himself more. I lost a good bit of weight. I was up to about 240, and then I dropped down to 160. And I've still got about 11 pounds to go to get out of being overweight. But at any rate, My problem seems to be exercise. I try to walk, and immediately my lower back and on down and up my shoulders and so forth, as Dr. Brewer probably may remember, just kills me. And what do I do about that? What, I've got a grandson that's 2 years old, so I do get moving a lot because I take care of him a good bit, but that's not like going to the gym.
Yes, sir. I know that's something that we always talk about and work on with pain and the need to exercise and overcoming those obstacles. Julie, you work a lot with patients who have medical problems such mm-hmm. as chronic pain, and they're really trying to improve their health through exercise. What are some of the points that you bring up in those discussions?
Well, first of all, I always like to say there's a difference between exercise and movement, and we really need to do both, and we really need to do several different types of activity. So a lot of times people think of exercise, I have to go run 5 miles in order to get, any kind of benefit. And really that's not the case. We want to get moving. We have a new saying that we say sitting is the new smoking, because we right. sit so much, whether we're watching TV, we're on the computer all the time, so sometimes just even some simple things like setting your watch to go off at the top of the hour, where you get up and you can walk to the mailbox, you can walk around, your house, just getting in some movement. I do love that, like the Fitbits, where people are accountable to how many steps, because we tend to underestimate how many calories we eat, and overestimate how much we're actually moving. So, that kind of helps you stay accountable, just, to where you can start to feel better. Because it certainly is a challenge and a hurdle with medical complications and fatigue. But actually, exercise gives you energy, can help give you energy. And I know it seems, not the case whenever you don't feel like it, but it does help to, stimulate some endorphins and get you moving. So even if we start just a little bit at a time. But even some things like Tai Chi is a wonderful exercise for people with, chronic fatigue syndrome. And, you're getting a lot of benefits like that, too. So we want to make sure we're moving throughout the day as much as possible, and then doing some activities that, are still involve a lot of movement, balance, to where we can slowly start progressing. And that's the other issue is not to stay complacent, but see if we can start to progress and set some new goals once we reach, those goals of getting up. The getting up's just the hardest part.
Right. Well, I think I'm getting towards the movement part and doing some things on that. like I said, with my grandson, but mm-hmm. also going to the mailbox, going around the house, trying to do my laundry, things like that. But I do that partially because it hurts me to sit. I can't sit for an hour. That's painful. Sometimes I have a tendency to go lie down, and I know that's not good, but sometimes it's the only way I can get relief for the pain in different areas. Where would you suggest I go for, like, the Tai Chi you mentioned, or...
Well, you know, of course, Willis-Knighton has great classes. You know, we have got all different types. We have Pilates and Tai Chi. And specifically for people with, you know, medical conditions, we have chair yoga. That way you have an instructor there that's watching you that can, you know, make sure you're doing all the moves correctly. If that's not an option for everybody, you know, there's also videos that you can buy. I love for people to buy videos and do them in their house, or there's, you know, lots of YouTubes. I just prefer being supervised, especially if you have a condition, you know, as much as possible. But, you know, also what I love about groups is the energy of the groups. There's other people in the group, you know, that probably have a lot of the same conditions that you do. And there is really power and synergy when we get together, like-minded people doing, you know, exercise too.
That does sound good. And I would love to get in a group, but I'm totally blind in my right eye, and I have severe, or at least advanced, glaucoma in my left. Mm. And so I can't drive, and I have to get a ride to that place, which I can arrange at times, due to my doctor appointments. But to do it three times a week is a problem. So the videos, it sounds like a good idea. Would I get that from Willis-Knighton also?
No, sir. You would just, you know, you could go online, and if you are familiar with, like, a YouTube, you could just put in Tai Chi, and you would have hundreds of free videos right at your fingertips.
And also, I love the idea of the stretching and different things like that. Those are great options rather than just, you know, if walking's an issue. I know you mentioned sitting, and I was going to suggest maybe a recumbent bike, because weight bearing could be, you know, something that causes you limitations. I wasn't sure if a recumbent bike activity would be an option for you as well.
It may be. I bought one. Dr. Brown's suggested that, and I got one, and I've used it some. I found that it sped up my heart rate really fast, and so I haven't used it to its full potential yet, but I'm working on it.
Okay, well, check your resistance on that and see if you got it on the lower resistance, because sometimes if it's at a higher resistance, that will cause your heart rate to go up. But yeah, just check on that and play around with it. But yeah, that could be another great option as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you for calling. You know, we really appreciate your efforts and attempts to do the best you can with those limitations, and we wish you the best, and I'll see you soon.
All right. Take care.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. We are talking about health, heart health tonight. And you can call with questions or comments at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Julie, when you talk to your patients about, you know, the dietary measures that we discuss with regards to heart health, and we talk about general, you know, dietary measures as well as more specific ones, is your discussion framed around what the patient's labs are, or does your discussion focus on, you know, what seems to be healthy for the population in general? Let's say diabetics versus people who have maybe high blood pressure versus people who have, you know, high lipid levels in their blood.
Well, this is what the exciting thing is about what we do in cardiac rehab. We encourage people to bring their spouses because, you know, really the top 15 killers, we're talking about the number one killer, but really the top 15 chronic diseases are all preventable and reversible with lifestyle medicine. And so that's why I get, you know, excited and encouraged to have people come, because, you know, what we're talking about is not only going to be great for heart, but it's going to be great for diabetes. It'll be great for cancer. cancer. It'll be great for Alzheimer's. It'll be, you know, it'll affect all of those things. And so we really do take, you know, kind of a wide approach. We definitely look at their lab values. And, you know, I really encourage them to be patient empowered. You know, I encourage them to not just wait for the doctor to call and say, your labs are fine. We'll see you next year. I want them to know their cholesterol levels. I want them to know their HDL, their LDL, their triglycerides, their blood sugars. If, you know, they're diabetic, their hemoglobin A1C, because they will make changes based on how much they measure. So it's like we go back to that goal setting. You know, if they can see a, you know, significant reduction in hemoglobin A1C, which is just a test that we measure, you know, blood sugar by, that you know, within 3 months of making lifestyle changes, you know, they've, you know, gone from an 8 to a 6, that's really significant. And they're going to be more excited and empowered about seeing that the lifestyle changes work. Whereas if the, you know, the nurse calls and says, well, we've, you know, you're fine, you're doing better, you know, we'll see it, you'll see you next time. They can't really, you know, make that connection that it's the lifestyle changes that make the difference. So we do take a big approach, you know, although it's, we still like to make it personal, but really everybody, no matter, you know, if it's blood pressure, diabetes, or heart disease, it's a very strong focus on whole foods, getting out processed foods, and focused on, you know, whole foods, but mainly plant foods. And so I don't like to come in because their mindset is already, I have to be on a cardiac diet. It's going to be bland. It's going to be yucky. You know, it's no salt. And so we really try to put the emphasis back on what they can have. Let's focus on all the things we're going to add into your diet that are going to be good, like the vegetables, instead of, you know, just saying all the things that we can't have. Because when we start to add in the good things, it tends to crowd out all the bad things. And so if we're adding in more water, it's going to be crowding out all of the, you know, maybe the sodas. If we're adding in 8 glasses of water a day, there didn't leave that much room to have, you know, all of the other, you know, bad habits that they're doing. So, you know, we really try to focus on the big picture, but still get personalized at the same time.
You know, a lot of diets focus on one particular component. You know, there are carbohydrates,
sure,
proteins, fats, and then fiber, mm-hmm, which is not necessarily a calorie component, but, you know, there's some diets that focus on high protein. Some diets focus on high fat. I don't know if there's a diet that focuses on carbohydrates. I hope not. But how do you frame that discussion in terms of if a patient comes to you and says, Julie, I want to completely eliminate carbohydrates from my diet?
Well,
is that a realistic,
completely, you know, eliminating carbohydrates from your diet is not a realistic idea. So, I really try to steer away from the word diet altogether because there's so many different labels and fads and, you know, and that sort of thing. And so we, you know, our basis is always whole foods, no processed foods, and then we kind of go from there. But what I found, you know, have found in practice is that sometimes people, you know, might need a little more protein, where others, you know, don't need as much. Sometimes carbohydrates affect people more specifically than they do others. And so it really is a, you know, a very personalized approach. But I just try to steer away from saying you need to be on a paleo diet or you need to be on, you know, this kind of diet other than, you know, a whole foods, unprocessed food diets. And then we go specifics, you know, into there because food affects people in such different ways. Sweet potatoes for one person might not raise their blood sugar, but for another, it might raise them 200, you know, points. So it's really about being in tune with a person on an individual basis.
You know, you bring up a really good point. Let's go through that a little bit because I had this discussion with someone not long ago. Is there a difference with regards to, you know, how the body treats a carbohydrate if it's in a big gulp, molecule for molecule, versus in a sweet potato or a carrot or a grape?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the, you know, eating the whole food, that's why, you know, it's important that we eat whole foods instead of, you know, just processed foods, because when a food is processed, and I have, you know, a saying we like to say is that a food needs to be a plant and not have been through a plant, meaning like a processing plant, because once, you know, I get the V8 question quite a bit. And so while V8 has, you know, started out with, you know, celery and tomatoes and garlic and those kinds of things, once it went through the processing plant, now it's pasteurized, now it has more sodium added, you know, now it's lost its fiber. And so when you consume a food that is devoid of those kinds of things, it does affect the level of blood sugar that's, you know, it'll affect the blood sugar quite a bit. So the whole foods, fiber, just like you said, it's not a calorie issue, but it affects their diet quite a bit.
Very good. Thank you so much. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. We are discussing heart health tonight on Health Matters. The number for your questions is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Jared, we were just listening to that discussion about diet. What would you add to that in terms of what do you tell patients who are specifically in cardiac rehab? They're probably healing from a bypass operation. Food's not been great in the hospital. About to go home. I hear patients every day, you know, they're ready to go home and stop by Waffle House on the way. They're so hungry after being in the hospital or having a procedure done. What does that discussion sound like in your world?
Well, I love the whole food mentality. I think that's kind of the foundation of what we try to look at. If a box has a bunch of ingredients on it you can't pronounce, you may want to kind of steer from that. But for patients, you know, around this area and you know, there's just this connotation that heart health food tastes bad. And, you know, you get this phrase, if it tastes good, then spit it out, you know, and that's not necessarily the case. That's not the case at all. I love heart health food. I think it tastes good. And that's part of the mentality that we need to change for them. And then we don't expect them to, I tell them, hey, I don't you expect you to do anything that I wouldn't do. And so we say, hey, you don't have to be 100% heart healthy. Boy, if we can really move the needle just a little bit and, you know, eat heart healthy 90% of the time, I mean, that's a big accomplishment. So we just take things one step at a time because it is a big adjustment for some. It's a big adjustment to change their eating patterns. So we try to do that in incremental steps.
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and get to our next caller. We have Linda from Longview. Linda, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi, I just have a quick question. If you could maybe explain this to me. I just turned my car on and heard this session. I've had a doctor tell me one time that you can have thick blood and it has a hypercoagulability to it and prevents oxygen to get where it needs to go, if I understood her. It's been a few years since I've talked to her. Could somebody explain that to me or clarify my question?
Absolutely. It's your lucky day. We've had the privilege and honor of having Dr. Trey Baucom join us tonight. Welcome, Dr. Baucom. So Linda's question, I guess hypercoagulable states in general, what would you say about that?
You know, that's interesting.
She was talking about thick blood. A thick blood.
Okay.
Right, and there's a couple of different ways your blood can be thick. There are hypercoagulable states where your blood clots too quickly, and then there are states where your blood is too viscous, and the most common one of those is when people produce too much blood. Those are actually pretty rare, and the people that produce too much blood, they have to have blood drained out periodically, and that really happens. And so those people have to donate blood or give blood sometimes every month to keep their hemoglobin and hematocrit from getting too high, which makes their blood viscous, and it can sludge and cause problems. But that's fairly rare. Sometimes when people are drawing blood or getting a simple test, they'll comment. They'll say, well, it seems too thick or it seems like it's coagulating too quickly. But usually that's not true. And so those are fairly rare problems, although they do exist.
Okay. So by looking at your blood work, you can't tell that from platelet counts or any of your blood work. You can't make that assumption from your...
No, if they do a complete blood count on you, they can tell if your platelets are way too high or if your hemoglobin and hematocrit, just your red blood cells, are way too high. That can cause increased viscosity of your blood.
Okay. so I could just look at my recent labs and look at that.
Yeah, if it's within normal ranges, then it's unlikely that you truly have too thick of blood.
Okay.
Linda, this is Dr. Okay. Brewer. If you don't mind, have you actually ever been diagnosed with a blood clot of any kind?
Well, I actually, when my younger daughter was born, I had one in my leg, which I think that was probably caused by hormones, you know. Of course, that was many years ago. But I have bad veins, you know, and I haven't planned on getting into this. I just have no energy when I walk, absolutely no energy. And, you know, I don't know what it is. If it's a lack of oxygen, if it's a lack of calcium, potassium, magnesium, something like that that helps transport oxygen. At a health fair one time, I had my the oxygen thing put on my finger, and there is a doctor there that, you know, I asked him a couple questions, and it was like 98 or 100, you know, it was right up there where it should be. And I asked him kind of the same question I'm trying to ask here, and he commented, well, just because the number is high doesn't mean the oxygen is getting where it needs to go. And it was the end of the health fair, and I didn't get a chance to ask any more about that. And I've always kind of had that question in the back of my mind, what he may have meant by that. If they put that thing on the end of your finger, wouldn't the oxygen be getting to the rest of your body also?
Well, actually, there is a phenomenon. So when your oxygenated blood goes out, only about 10% of the oxygen is extracted by your body normally. And so your blood could actually circulate a few times and still be useful to your muscles and, you know, your brain. But there is a phenomenon where people have a very low cardiac output where their blood has such a slow transit time that much more oxygen is extracted from it. And your body can sense when the arterial oxygen level is low, but it can also sense when the venous blood is low, the oxygen level, and that can cause fatigue. And that we see that in people that have a very weak pumping heart. If you've already had a blood clot, though, you might ought to get an evaluation for the hyperviscosity syndromes. There's protein S, protein C. There's sort of a panel of tests that they can check because a pregnancy doesn't normally induce a blood clot. And so that you might be at risk and you might have something else going on. So I would probably encourage you to get that checked.
What'd you call it? Protein what?
There's protein S and protein C deficiencies, and those are two of the most common hypercoagulable states. Where your blood is too thick.
Okay, because, I mean, I know I have bad veins in my legs. It's a hereditary thing in my family. So.
And that can cause fatigue in your legs and heaviness, and there's a treatment for that, too. So I would encourage you to get this evaluated.
So I don't know which kind of doctor to go to first, because the primary doctor, when I've talked to her and even my gynecologist, you know, the conversation doesn't seem to go any further. I don't know who else to go to. And I've been on a treadmill a couple of different times. I mean, years ago when I was in tip-top shape, the doctor was a part of a physical, and he said, you know, I says, I think we're going to have to stop you because you keep going and we keep elevating it and making it go faster. And then, well, I don't know how many years later, I had another one, and I had to ask them to stop because I was just out of energy. So, I mean, I was almost to the end, but...
Well, Linda, it sounds like, you know, a good primary care evaluation, if you had that blood work around the time that you had the blood clot, you know, that information may still be available. But it seems like, a good yearly checkup, what they'll do is they'll look at your labs related to maybe your thyroid gland. Maybe do a physical examination, make sure that there's no... You know, muscular problems, things like fibromyalgia can cause chronic fatigue. There's what we call a wide differential when it comes to, lack of energy and difficulty with, blood flow problems. But it sounds like, it could be something unrelated to your heart. Nothing really, sticks out in your history from, what you've told Dr. Baucom and myself. It could be more related to... a different process, but I would certainly encourage you to get a general evaluation for that. And it's called a hypercoagulable panel, And your primary care doctor will know exactly what you're talking about.
Coagulable panel? Okay.
Yes.
I applaud you for, trying to find answers for it. And I want to encourage you to keep on persevering and trying to find answers, see what's going on. And also, don't give up on that, the exercise, the walking thing. I know you got a little frustration with, some shortness of breath, but others have that as well, and they let that get them down or frustrated. But I want you to keep on going, keep on pushing on, and keep on going on that exercise routine.
That's good advice.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Linda, thank you so much for calling us here on Health Matters tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm joined here on Health Matters for Heart Health Week with Dr. Trey Baucom, advanced cardiac or cardiovascular specialist, as well as Mr. Jared Mitchell with Willis-Knighton Cardiac Rehabilitation and Julie Hartley with Willis-Knighton Dietitian Services. We are taking calls. You can call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR. Public Radio. Dr. Baucom, thank you for joining us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Randy, sorry I was running late.
Oh, no worries. I know it's tough in the evenings. You know, there's so many competing events, especially this time of year. So in your world, in terms of what's going on with heart health, we've been talking a lot about preventive strategies. We've been talking about, different strategies in terms of diet, modifiable risk factors, things that we can change in terms of our health and lifestyle management, and then unmodifiable risk factors such as age, sex, family history of heart disease. From your perspective, what are some of the more important things people need to be thinking about in today's times in terms of what's the next thing they need to do in terms of their heart health? Let's just say someone who may have a few risk factors there, but they haven't had a cardiac issue yet. How would you counsel patients to start thinking more proactively about their heart health?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. I mean, it's getting harder and harder in our fast-paced society to exercise, and people really don't get nearly enough exercise. And to prevent heart disease, all you have to do is walk a mile a day, and that's not that much. I mean, that's basically 20 to 30 minutes of walking a day, and you can break it up into 10 minutes three times a day. But it's amazing how little people exercise sometimes in our society. So if they really just start off walking, I tell people park further away from the door, walk farther in the parking lot, take the stairs. I mean, simple things like that really do make a difference. People feel like it doesn't make a difference, but it does. And then eating healthy. And there's so many diets, and there's so many things. It gets very confusing for people, and I'm here with a professional, so I'll get a little bit out of my territory. But the first thing I tell people is prepare their own food. If they use fresh ingredients and prepare their own food, they're way ahead of the game. I mean, it's so much better for you than pre-processed food. So baking a cookie from scratch is a lot better for you than eating an Oreo. I happen to like Oreos, but, a scratch cookie, if you're going to have a cookie, is better for you. So if you start a moderate exercise program, really just walking, keep moving, and start eating a healthier diet, lots of whole grains, there's lots of things, but preparing it yourself, if you're eating at home and you're preparing your own food, you're really going to be way ahead of the game. And then the obvious ones, of course, don't smoke.
Yeah, it's so easy to not do that. We have probably 30 places that we could eat between here and getting back to the office, right? It's just,
right.
Unimaginable how much food is out there just at our disposal, just within a few minutes. And so what a great tip, making your own food. You can make it with someone, it can be a social event. You're not in a loud restaurant, trying to figure out what to order that could be healthy off of a menu. What a great tip.
And you burn calories making the food. So,
yeah.
I mean, we've programmed movement out of our lives in a way, We used to have to get up and turn the TV channel, but now we do it by remote. So,
right.
They've done so many studies, and there's always people studying every aspect of our life. But, I have four children. So one thing that stuck in with me was I saw a study years ago that said the single most impactful thing you can do for your children as far as keeping them on the right path, off drugs, out of trouble, is to have dinner with them every night. Sit down and have dinner with your children every night. And that sort of kills two birds, because particularly if you prepare dinner with them, you burn some calories, you're using fresher produce, And then you sit down with them, which is a calming effect on everybody. At least the beginning of the meal is calm. And it's just good for you. It's a good, healthy lifestyle tip that's pretty simple. I mean, it takes some discipline to do it because it's so easy to stop and pick up food on the way. But if you do that with your family, it's very beneficial.
I have to say, I'm a really big fan of the new, meal delivery services, things like HelloFresh or Blue Apron. And first of all, I'm loving to hear a doctor say, you know, do those things at home, because it's things that are simple to do or really simple to forget for a lot of people. And so it's fast paced. It's all this, but those meal delivery services, a lot of times encourage them to get the vegetarian meals. That way, they're getting lots of vegetables or at least having a plant-based meal, you know, a couple of times a week. And then they can add in some of their own, meats, healthier, good quality meats, too, if they want. But it's fun. It's the whole family gets involved. You know, the shopping's already done for you. The recipes are already done for you. And then they can just experiment with different kinds. Because I think that's one of the biggest pushbacks of people cooking at home is, I don't know what to cook. I don't know what to try. And they get in their same, routine of cooking the same old thing. So it's just been a neat thing that's come around in the last year or so that I really have utilized in practice and with patients, especially for those that are just one or two people, cooking at home. That's really difficult to do too. So there's lots of options they can do, one for a two-person household or, up to four, five, and six people.
I think that's great advice because I've seen that break people out of their food rut.
Mm-hmm.
We all kind of get in this menu and we'll cook the same things over and over and over again. I think like Blue Apron will make you get a little bit out of the box, but then you get the benefit of it's fresher and you prepare it yourself. And so that's good advice.
Anything that you have control over at home is going to be so much better. Just like you said, whenever we're eating the same, even if you're eating a salad out or grilled chicken, they're going to use more fat, more calories, more sodium than you ever would at home. So as much as you can control your meal, the healthier it's going to be.
You know, one thing you mentioned, Julie, was, healthy meats. Tell us a little bit more about healthy meats. There are those who would say that there's not really such a thing as a healthy meat, but
higher quality. The most of the meats that are in our grocery store now, a lot of the animals are not taken care of. I usually say we are what we eat, but we are what our animals eat as well. So we have to pay attention to what they're being fed. Most cows now are not eating grass like they should, which completely changes their meat. When they eat grass, it's a higher omega-3 fatty acid profile than if they're just fed corn and soy and byproducts, which is what they do now. So really, I really try to teach people to be very specific, but having less of it. We still need more plants in our diet, less animal products, for sure. But when we do have animal products, being really picky about the kinds that we have.
Yeah, and I think, it was maybe a year or two ago, the World Health Organization actually classified red meat as a carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it has to do with something that's specific to animal products in the meat, or if it's, more related to their diet or additives to their meat. So we know that there's something about, those animal products that is not quite as healthy as the same amount of protein or same amount of fat from plant-based products.
Absolutely. It's a big picture, and it's mostly, what they're being fed, how they're being treated, infections that happen because they're in such close quarters, all are going to affect their meat. And that's not just with cats, all animals, like that. Even fish, are farm fed, not eating what they would normally do. So just being really, really picky and really looking for high quality. But again, it's, focus on the getting the processed food out. If we can start doing those kinds of things first, those are really the biggest drivers in your health diet.
Dr. Baucom, in the few minutes that we have left, tell us, if you will, any of the new developments that, have occurred in your field. And one thing in particular I wanted to ask you about, something that was in the news not long ago, the coronary calcium score was something that I saw in the news not long ago, but if you could maybe mention a little bit about, early detection of coronary disease in people with risk factors, and then anything that you see that's emerging that you'd like to mention to folks this year.
Yeah, the coronary calcium scoring is a great test as a screening test for certain people. particularly as a tiebreaker if you're trying to decide how aggressive to be with someone's risk factor modification. And so they do a CAT scan. There's no iodine involved. And they can detect how much calcium you have on your coronary arteries. Calcium shows up very bright on a CAT scan or an X-ray. And it's a sign of hardening of the arteries. Now, it doesn't necessarily indicate blockage forming inside the artery. But if you get enough calcium, there is a correlation between that. It's best as a negative predictor. So if you get a calcium score and it's zero or a very low number, you know you're probably not going to have heart disease. And then as far as earlier detection other ways, it gets more difficult. Stress testing is pretty accurate, but stress testing is best if you're having symptoms. And so if you're having chest pain or shortness of breath, or for women just fatigue, a stress test is very useful because it gives us physiologic information about how your heart's doing and whether or not you have any blockage. And then really, it's just risk factor screening. If you have, watch your cholesterol, don't smoke, watch your blood pressure. And then a lot of times, if we can image some artery in your body, like your carotid vessels, which are easy to image, we get a pretty good idea of going on with your whole vascular tree. If your carotids have no blockage and they're smooth and not thickened, that's a good sign that the rest of your body is probably doing pretty well. Calcium scoring, like I said, is a useful tool, but it's just one of them. And unfortunately, it's not appropriate for everybody. If you already have known coronary artery disease, it's not helpful.
Let's go ahead and take another caller. We have Justice from Nacogdoches. Justice, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
How can we help you?
So I actually had a question in reference to an issue that my girlfriend has been having for a number of years now. We've gone to multiple cardiologists and have not had any luck. Now, I'll start by saying that she does have a little bit of a leaky valve and some bradycardia, but she's never really had an issue with it. She's been an athlete pretty much her whole life, former dancer competitively, and never really had any problems. Now, in these past few years, this did occur one time in high school. She had an episode where she got lightheaded and passed out, but she wore a monitor for about a month and they couldn't find anything. But in the past few years, she's had multiple episodes where we'll go a couple months or maybe a couple weeks without anything. But then for a period of probably about a week or two, up to, you know, a couple times a day, she'll get very lightheaded. She'll get very lethargic, angina, some chest pains, and she'll pass out wherever she is. And she'll go out for, you know, maybe about 45 seconds at a time. A lot of times she'll stop breathing, and then she'll kind of come to, have a bit of pain, and this will go on for about 15 minutes at a time, and maybe for a duration of about up to 45 minutes. We really have gone to multiple cardiologists. They haven't been able to find anything out. Kind of at a dead end here.
How old is she?
She is 27 years old.
So the most common reason that people pass out is a reflex that we all have in our body. And so, you know, your heart's a pump that has to constantly pump blood, and it can never pump more blood out than is returning to it. That has to be matched. And it's like breathing. We sort of take it for granted that our body will do it. And there's sensors all over our body that are giving a tremendous amount of information to our brain and back to our heart about what's going on. When you get in a situation where your heart is pumping out more blood than is returning to it, your heart shrinks down to as small as it can get. When it's as small as it can get, it stimulates what are called the C fibers, and that starts a complex reflex called the Jarsch-Bezold reflex that will make your heart rate drop dramatically and your blood pressure drop. And that is by far the most common reason people pass out, particularly at her age range. There's a test called a head-up tilt test that can often be helpful for that. And that's probably the most common thing. Now, the angina and the other problems she's having with it, sometimes people get a big adrenaline spike after they pass out and they'll have some tachycardia. But it is very concerning that she may be having one of the other reasons people pass out, like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and arrhythmia. And I know it's frustrating. We've already been to a bunch of cardiologists, but sometimes you just have to be persistent. But a head-up tilt test and maybe an implantable monitor. We have monitors now that we can implant under your skin that lasts for several years. That actually, the newest one has an app on your iPhone where you can trigger it. And so I think you just have to be persistent. But out of the box, the most common reason in a 27-year-old is neurocardiogenic syncope, which can almost always be treated.
How would we treat that?
The most common treatment, which sounds ironic, is a beta blocker. It's a high blood pressure medicine, but given in low doses, it prevents syncope.
You know, I forgot to mention, she actually, she had one, I think he actually might have been a general practitioner who, I'm sorry, I can't remember if he's a cardiologist. We've been to so many doctors who actually attempted to give her a B12 shot. Well, he did give her a B12 shot. Now, she's also anemic, but he gave her a B12 shot, and for about 6 months, this is the longest period, she had no symptoms whatsoever, no lethargy, no lightheadedness, no passing out, no angina, and no apnea with it. What do you think about that?
Justice, we're going to have to, move on to the next segment right there. But I think, you know, a good recommendation is going to be just keep asking those questions. If you need a second opinion, there are a lot of great cardiologists in the area. I know you're down in Nacogdoches. Mm-hmm. Whether you go to Houston or you come up here to Shreveport or Dallas, being an advocate for your family member there, that's a tremendous asset that she has there. And we would just encourage you to, just keep asking the questions, and it might be a good idea to journal the symptoms and take that to your evaluation as well. Thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight. Thanks to all our guests. We're going to have to get right in to the next segment. This is 89.9 KDAQ Shreveport, 90.7 KLSA Alexandria, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado, and 88.9 Lufkin Nacogdoches. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.